Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
So Dalai Lama plunges into the subject of truth suffering. And this is a very Vajrayana version of it. And as I thought about it and worked with it last week, I realized how I never really understood this part of it. The desire form and formless realms. There are supposed to be three realms of suffering, and in all of the realms we are having a very hard time based on self-clinging. So it really comes down to holding on to the form of our own body and the feelings that it engenders. Form, feeling, impulses,
consciousness.
All of those. Every one. So the form of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, etc. Each one of those we hold on. We want something. So the basis of it all is desire. So there's a great deal about rebirth as part of it. The formless realms are meditation and equanimity and the sense that the universe is coming and going, it's changing all the time. It's a kind of massive view of how things are. but what Buddha actually said was more simple. As it comes through here, any form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, in oneself or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near, that is offered by, affected by taints and provocative of clinging. That's called the form category, affected by clinging. So instead of talking about desire, which is how it comes through with Dalai Lama, in this translation it's considered to be clinging. And in my ear, that sounds more like it. That, of course, we have many desires. We have essential survival desires. Sometimes people get all hung up on this because how can we eat if we don't desire food? How can we procreate if we don't desire sex? Etc., etc. There are five desires: food, sex, shelter, sleep, and being known by others. These are all five survival modes for being a human being. And Buddha's not talking about those because we need to survive. He tried to control himself by starving himself, and it didn't work. He had to accept food and re-engage with life. So it's not about that. It's how we use our mind, how we approach our experience. And of course, we love life. We do. But there is something about us that is always wanting more. And a little bit more of that too. If it's especially delicious, we really, really want it and want to keep it. And it's impossible. That was Buddha's basic understanding and message and his experience. It's impossible. We can't. So we're left with this conflict going on inside us, and it's just our own thinking. It isn't real, of what we think we need and have to have and what we actually have or don't have, which is sometimes a real different experience. It's very interesting, really, if you start to watch your mind and see how this works. It's fascinating. It's built into us. But it's really important to understand the source of our suffering is based on this also, on the clinging. Since we're talking about the first noble truth, that's just the truth of suffering. And the instruction by Buddha is to study hard, study yourself so that you can accept the truth of this. Because otherwise you won't understand the rest of it. If you don't really see how you cling to things, where your misery is coming from, you won't see what a dream it is. You won't see how to let it go. You'll be stuck over and over and over again. And you won't be able to help anybody else because you won't be able to see it in them either. Sometimes I think that Zen practice is about helping each other by pulling the rug out from under each other. Everybody has these very fast-held ideas, and to be able to find a way of just tweaking it a little bit, saying, well, that's one way of looking at it, but how about this? And turn it around and loosen things up so that the mind isn't clutching onto things so tightly. We live in an era where we are all tightly held and holding. We're pummeled by ideas, thoughts. It's just thoughts. It's theories. And in the midst of all the thoughts and theories is our actual life going on, which we hardly notice sometimes. It's very strange. So our Zen practice is to simply sit and come back over and over to seeing where we are and who we are. Just this. And it doesn't mean that we don't have lots of ideas about things. We need ideas. We need to be creative and do as much as we can to think our way through all our life. Life is so fascinating, we'll never get to the bottom of it. To keep looking and looking. Be deeply curious, but not hold on. So he says these five categories affected by clinging, form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness, these five, us in other words, you and me, our mind and body, our speech, our life, these things have desire for their root. We're built on desire. The four great entities of earth, water, fire, and air are the cause and condition for describing the form category. Contact is that for describing the categories of feeling, perception, and formation. Name and form is that for describing the consciousness category. That's it right there. Just this little bit. It's the Heart Sutra all over again. So he goes on to say, whatever monks or Brahmins recollect their past life is in its various modes, they all recollect the five categories affected by clinging or one of the others. So if we're going to be reborn, we'll still keep remembering because we studied it so hard. You'll have to forgive me, I forgot my glasses. So there's cosmology in here and a lot of things I won't cover. Abhidharma also. Those are deep philosophical notions that it's not really important for us, I think. Generally speaking, says Dalai Lama, the Buddhist understanding is that birth as a human being is one of the most ideal forms of existence because it is conducive to practicing Dharma. I always think that's so encouraging. We can do it. We're able to do it. I don't think my cat can quite do it, though she has a clue, but it's not the same. She doesn't have language, for one thing. He says all beings in this world are under the control of delusion and afflictive emotions. In some sense, one could say that they are actually the products of delusion and afflictive emotions. So in a way, you could say it's all a big misunderstanding. We think we understand how things are, but if we look at it carefully, maybe it's not like that. Maybe it's delusional in some way. Maybe it's based on our ignorance. So there are three forms of suffering. The suffering of suffering. Oh, I forget. I'm sorry, I'm not very good at this.
Angie, would you like to... These are just kind of non-prescription.
Oh, thank you, Leslie, but they won't work.
Oh, okay.
I have very strange eyes. There's the suffering of suffering, which is just plain old suffering. And then the suffering of conditioning, which addresses the main question, why is this the nature of things? The answer is because everything that happens in samsara is due to ignorance. So all comes around every single time. That's why when we say the Bodhisattva vows, we vow to end ignorance, meaning one little tiny piece at a time. It sounds like a big demand on ourselves, a big blow, but no, there's no way. But we can live through our ignorance and pay such close attention that we can see when we're making a mistake of what's actually going on. We make many mistaking. It's not a bad thing. It's just that often we need to slow down and pay attention, pay closer attention. The third level of suffering refers to the bare fact of our unenlightened existence. We've had it. We're not there yet. This is one view. It's under the influence of this fundamental confusion of the negative karma to which confusion gives rise. So if we're confused, then we create turmoil and confusion in our life. Our mind becomes confused and everything around us is out of sync. This state of existence serves as the basis not only for painful experiences in this life, but also for the causes and conditions of suffering in the future. So the more confused we are, the more we are creating more confusion tomorrow. So what Buddha said about this is that since everything is changing all the time, that we can't nail anything down, that the whole idea of clinging is an absurdity, because nothing can be fixed. We ourselves cannot be fixed. As we know very well, we're not the same person we were 10 years ago, or 40 years ago, or ever. Actually, every moment, we're slightly different people. And we're breathing in and out. I was just reading the molecules from Napoleon and Socrates. Those molecules are still floating around in the air, and we are made of them. So it's not just that everything is constantly, conditionally changing, but that we're made up of all these other beings. We're not fixed in any way. And much of our suffering comes from clinging to this whole notion of ourself. And that's the second noble truth. That seeing that, noticing that, and then seeing through it. Oh, I think I'm like that, but maybe I'm not. I was like that. Am I still? Does it matter what I'm like? What is it really? What is this thing I call myself? Who's me? So his final on this is, within the three realms, there are states which are comparatively more joyful than others. However, so long as we remain within samsara, whether in the form realm, the formless realm, or the desire realm, there is no escape for joy to be lasting. In the final analysis, we are in a state of dukkha, dissatisfaction. This is the meaning of the third type of suffering. We are never quite satisfied. So I think that's enough. Definitely enough. So discussion, questions? Roman.
So where I went with what you were talking about was, first off, I mean, the first noble truth for me was a gimme. It just was, obvious.
Yeah.
There's no gray area, but when I look at it, this samsara, right, that I'm, living my pretty deluded life most of the time, as I crash into other people or situations and I cycle it through the skandhas, right? I feel like what's happening there, as I'm kind of fumbling around with different teachings, is that I'm catching myself in this dukkha at some point, between form and perception. I guess somewhere in that area is where I'm starting to see it. kind of as I head in that direction, I usually fall in that trap door where things get bad. So I think the more I'm in the moment with the cause of my suffering, my dissatisfaction, that's where the practice is for me.
Yes.
I can go home, I go home and my cushion's there and I sit on it. And I face the wall, I face myself, and I spend a little time. But it's like just today, my son got in a little trouble. A little bit of trouble, nothing serious. It's fallen into, my and my wife's lap, And I started getting really angry at him. He wasn't even there. I was actually supposed to be working. And I saw it for what it was, and I just kind of put it down, And that's the nuts and bolts of how that plays out for me.
That's excellent. Yeah, that's how it works. So once you know it's there, you don't have to do it. That's the secret. And then, of course, Buddha goes on to say what the reasons are, which you've scoped out already, and then that there is a relief. And then the Eightfold Path is all the different ways that we can live a life that has integrity. That's all it is. It isn't some fancy thing. It's not a big Buddhist thing. It's just how to live a life of integrity. How to be authentic. And how to see our ignorance as we see it. And learn from it. It's very beautiful. Thank you for that. I hope he's okay.
How are you?
I had three little boys. I know what it's like. Karen?
So this may sound annoying of a question, but I was just curious.
curious why, I mean, I can think of lots of reasons why your cat wouldn't be able to do Zen, but I'm surprised you said the language was the limiting bit.
I think language is what makes us human. Yes, we definitely do. Even though we say no words, right, we're all based on no words. But as you may notice, the library in Zen and in Buddhism is huge. So you have to have a lot of language in order to point to no language. It's just like that.
Well, I've come to realize and experience, you know, when it kind of came to suffering, that it seems to be passed down many generations, because I've noticed, like, people I know, you know, who are suffering, like, you know, personally.
Yes.
Then I find out the whole family and generations before them are suffering. And then I come to think, like, how do you break away and end it so that way the future generations don't suffer?
This is our job.
Yeah, and
it's to break that cycle.
To break that cycle.
And they're studying it now. They can actually, they've discovered some of the reality of that, how the DNA and RNA are transmitted to us from our parents.
But then I realized, because I thought, okay, the more I sit, you know, I could help. But then I noticed that the clinging comes in.
Yeah.
If I cling onto my family and the generations before that, I'm actually not helping the future generation, because I'm clinging onto the pattern that they have passed on down and taught, you know, down the line.
Yes.
And I've come to realize that if I decide not to no longer cling to my family patterns whatsoever, and just totally just let that go along with the past, I have found a lot more freedom from everything.
Yes.
I mean, I found the freedom and the happiness, because no longer am I carrying the burden of the generations before me. And then I feel like something broke through when I see my children. Not like I told them anything, but I just like sort of the energy change, it shifted.
Yes.
And it was like, you know, it was like that non-clinging to your family, because I've seen my friends still go through so much suffering, and they're just so clinging to the past, to their, of what they have learned, the patterns of carrying without changing their patterns, and then that suffering just continues on down.
It does.
And until your last breath, and then it doesn't help in the practice of what you're, for that freedom.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they say that if we practice that freedom, that it goes back seven generations. It frees up the back generation seven times.
It's a big undertaking.
And goes forward seven generations. You actually save the next seven generations.
Yeah, I heard that too, and I put myself through that process, and it's a big undertaking, because
it is.
You did have to destroy so many delusions and illusions and attachments that that means, you know, just a total, you know, freedom, and it's very painful.
Yeah.
But then once you get with that, you're happy.
Thank you for doing that good work. You do it for everyone, really.
That's what I learned. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm hoping when the future generations no longer come and carry, I can carry on what I see in the pattern of what my past generations have done, this is repeat itself over and over again.
Wonderful.
Yeah. But it's not easy.
It's not easy. No, thank you. Thank you for doing that. Paul?
I see meditation as taking a break from myself.
Great just, way of thinking of it.
Just give myself up for an hour. Yeah. Or so. I don't need him. Let him just go away. And when I get back to my everyday self, I'm not the same.
Exactly.
It's not like I did anything.
Yes.
Of course I did, but you know, it just sort of happened by itself.
Right.
And it's a wonderful pastime.
It is, isn't it?
It really is.
It's the best.
Yeah, I kind of like it. I'm very, very happy I discovered it.
Yeah, I am too.
Yeah.
I am too. Thank you.
Is there a word for the opposite of dukkha? That's the same.
Well, Dalai Lama calls it happiness. And I'm sure there is a word for it, but I don't know. We talk about wisdom and compassion as the result of our practice, that we become our what we are, which is really wisdom and compassion as one thing, one way of being in the world, and a connected way of being in the world. But I'm sure there is a word. We'll have to find out. Yeah. Well, it's 8 o'clock. Thank you all. Do our 1 minute sit. Oh, are there announcements first? No announcements. I'll sit.